funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Imagine these job requirements. 80-hour weeks every week, the expectation that you will answer emails sent after midnight immediately, and if a life-threatening illness or family crisis throws you off your game at the office temporarily, well, you might need to dust off your resume. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Life is notoriously tough for folks on staff at Amazon.com, at least according to current and former employees interviewed for a New York Times article published last weekend. For the record, CEO Jeff Bezos says he wants employees to alert him to inhumane management practices, but he doesn't deny that he demands a great deal from his staff. Now many of Amazon's customers are faced with the question of whether patronizing Amazon makes us complicit in the way it treats its workers. And if we have an ethical obligation to the workers of companies we do business with, exactly how far does it extend? Joining us to talk about this are three experts in business ethics. Nancy Boyd-Lilly is professor in the Department of Management at UNT. Steve Hiltz is adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at SMU. Larry Chunko is professor of business ethics at UTA. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amazon is worth now an estimated $250 billion, which means it's not only employing a lot of people, but the way it does business is going to influence a lot of other companies. Is there reason to believe it is placing significantly more pressure on its workers than its competitors?
No. From what I know about the tech sector, it's not uncommon at all.
So Amazon got caught for something a lot of companies are doing.
Yeah. That's my impression. It's a very competitive market, and you know, being the innovative, on top, you know, company is the key to success. And I think a lot of these companies, I think more companies than we realize, probably operate this way.
I would agree with that. And the other thing I would kind of say that, you know, I read the article, and I think I'd read some other things, and the things that were being said in that article were pretty gruesome. What I would want to know would be things like, well, that was 100 of their employees who signed off on that, and they have 180,000 employees. So what are the rest of the folks thinking out there in terms of this? And it's not to discount that article or discount the seriousness of those events that took place. And in fact, quite the contrary. I think they probably are at risk for some serious litigation down the line with some of those things that have taken place. But it's almost like a focus group kind of a snapshot of a few people, and we don't know how those people were found, how they were actually created and the like. So I'm not trying to defend Amazon. I'm just simply saying it may be that that is a reflection of the company, but we don't know that from what's been printed so far.
One thing that's really interesting to me about this and the reaction to this story of corporate management practices at Amazon is that for years we've been hearing about really tough conditions at distribution warehouses run by Amazon. And it should be noted a lot of other big companies have been criticized for similar practices. It seems, though, to be more surprising to people to learn that white-collar workers are treated harshly.
It's pretty easy to treat white-collar workers harshly because they fall under fewer labor laws that govern hours per week and things like that. If you're a professional, then there's no limit to your work week. There's no overtime pay, for example. It's whatever it takes to get the job done. And so I think it's pretty easy to, you know, become, I guess some people might call, abused. I wanted to point out that I think some people kind of thrive on that kind of environment. So it has to be, I mean, you have to know what you're getting into. But I think that some people thrive on it. They love it.
I don't think it's just the white-collar employees, though, because the one thing that struck me, I guess, most about the article when I read it was that the scene where there are people on the assembly line or in the warehouse where it was very hot and people were actually dropping and they had to have 1,000 boxes come off per hour or something like this. And people were actually they had ambulances waiting to take them to the hospital when they were exhausted. That seemed as harsh as anything that the white-collar people had to deal with.
And it does, it makes you wonder about having done business with a company. We A lot of people love Amazon. A lot of people love that you can get a package delivered now sometimes within hours if you live in certain areas, certainly within a couple of days, and we don't want to pay any extra for it. Is our assumption that we can have everything as consumers playing into the way the company feels forced to treat its employees, or does that give them too much of a pass?
Well, the articles that I read alluded to the fact that they think that the customer comes first, which is not a bad idea. But if they carry that to the customer is always right, then I think they're making a mistake because customers can be wrong. But if you have that sort of philosophy, then that kind of drives through every element of at least the marketing and the management of the marketing of that company in terms of making sure that we don't miss out on meeting expectations of customers. And when we do, you know, there might be penalties that come your way. And the article alluded to a lot of penalties or at least thoughts of penalties that might be occurring inside that organization.
Even beyond the hours and the conditions being tough, I was really stunned by what sounds like a deliberate practice of trying to get employees to fight with each other, not simply to be the best, but to let somebody know that you have a coworker who is slacking off. There's this process by which employees are encouraged to anonymously report on coworkers. I think we've all wished for that in the workplace, right, here and there, but mostly you realize that people just need to vent steam and don't necessarily have anything against the other people they work with. It sounds pretty toxic.
The whole work culture seems – the work ethic seems kind of toxic, and I do think it's related to the extreme emphasis on efficiency. They represent as efficiency in satisfying customer satisfying customers' needs and wants. But I think it's really efficiency in generating as much profit from the organization as possible, and they'll do that by – their plan is to do that by satisfying their customers as much as possible. It seems like this notion of efficiency uber alles is sort of like the reigning idea, and I think that's what's behind the efforts to extract as much productivity from your workforce as you possibly can, sort of regardless of how you're treating them and what you're making their lives like.
I felt like that process of feedback, continuous feedback, where you can rat out your coworkers went hand in hand with the performance appraisal system that they talked about, that they used a what we would call like a forced ranking. So you're forcing your workforce into a normal distribution. And that means somebody's going to be at the bottom. And of course, nobody wants to be at the bottom. So I think that in order to prevent that, then you've got to make your coworkers look worse than you do. So it really creates a toxic workforce where people are backstabbing one another to try and work their way up the curve so that they're not – then their job isn't on the line at the end of the review period, because from what I could tell by that, that's the logical conclusion. If you're in that bottom percentile, then you get cut. And they spoke to the idea that Amazon has tremendous turnover, that – you know, 1 year at Amazon is like a long time. You've been there a long time if you've been there a year.
There was this line in the piece by which people who became one with the machine of the company were called Amabots, and I don't know if that's a derogatory term or something that people aspire to.
I think they aspired to it and took it on as their own.
It struck me that, you know, the kind of loyalty and incredibly hard, you know, above 100% kind of effort that the company expects that it kind of turns our stomachs is something that we admire in people who work in other places. You know, you hear about Marines and how hard they train, and somehow we don't think to question the organization. And granted, the ultimate purpose is different, but it is a question of how we think workers ought to be treated.
Well, the Marines don't fight each other, I think.
Well, and theoretically. That,
well, yes. Yeah. Anyway, as far as we know. But I think part of this stems from the top. As I was reading the article, I was kept thinking, this sounds like Enron. You know, at Enron, the object was to do the biggest deal you could possibly do, and everybody kind of closed their ears and eyes and said, we don't care how you get it done. I can't remember the phrase that they use at Amazon, but something like breakthrough ideas or something along those lines. But it smacked of the really big deal. And when you pit people against that, particularly if there are large rewards that occur as a result of achieving one of those things, you invite that kind of backbiting criticism, oftentimes maybe even saying things that aren't true. With one illustration of the young lady who was in the military, had a baby, and she started working from, I think it was like 7:30 to 4:30. And so she was putting in a full day, and she got creamed by her employees, said she wasn't there long enough because she was leaving earlier. They didn't know she got there at 7:30.
Is it possible that all these employees are putting in a full day of work, and then at some point you kind of hit a wall? And the word at Amazon is that you hit the wall and then you climb the wall. But do you think people can people give 16 hours of their best energy every single day? Or is there likely an element of face time in that corporate culture?
I don't think you can do it long term. You know, and I think it's really hard to keep up that kind of pace long term. I think some employees may see that as I'll do some time at Amazon and it'll open some doors for mm-hmm. me somewhere else. There was another article, I think it was yesterday, that talked about how these tech companies like Google and so forth are getting raided by the younger companies and how competitive it is, that companies like Uber and Airbnb are stealing employees from the older tech companies and luring them with higher pay or the promise of higher pay, going public, making a bundle of money when it goes public. And so I think that you know that if you can put in your time at Amazon, there are other doors that are going to open for you. So there may be a strategy to some of these employees that if they get their foot in the door here, it's going to open doors in other places mm-hmm. for them.
Well, as an analogy, in the sales area, Procter & Gamble may still play that role, but used to play that role of bringing people in. And a lot of the students would hire in with them knowing they would get great sales training in kind of a tough environment. And then 2 or 3 years later, they would move out and move on to some other company. And Procter & Gamble was okay with that because the ones that stayed were doing, really great work for them and sort of survived the ordeal, if you will, of the first 2 or 3 years on that job.
How much does an approach like Amazon's end up spilling over into the companies that want contracts with Amazon to sell their widgets on that site? Years ago, Walmart, of course, was criticized for really putting the squeeze on many of the manufacturers that it bought from, so that, after a while, everybody has to do business in a certain way if they want to have their products placed there. Is the same thing probably happening with Amazon?
As an outsider, I can't say it is, yeah. But my guess would be that it is because they are a place that you can put your products and they'll sell. And that provides Amazon with a kind of a really strong power in the marketplace. And they can kind of look at you and say, okay, if you don't want to work within our terms, where else are you going to go? Mm-hmm. So I think that they have in sort of a channels type of thing, they really do have the power in the marketplace, much like a Walmart does in the bricks and mortar retail space that's out there.
We're talking about business and consumer ethics today with three experts in the field. We have Larry Chunko here from UTA, Nancy Boyd Lilly from UNT, and Steve Hiltz from SMU. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can join it at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In light of revelations about Amazon's corporate management practices, we're talking today about ethics with three experts who come to us from academia. Steve Hiltz is with SMU in the Department of Philosophy. Nancy Boyd Lilly joins us from the Department of Management at UNT, and Larry Chonko from the Business School at UTA. If you would like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 800-933-5372 or email think at KERA.org. Is it reasonable, Steve, to ask whether a company's obligation to customers starts and ends with providing a good customer experience? So often, companies position themselves like we're a family, and is that just inherently false?
Well, I think you're asking two things. I think one, the obligation to customers is pretty much to see that they're satisfied, give them good products at a reasonable price, and safe products, et cetera. But they have other obligations. They have obligations to employees, which seems to be what's the problem here. And it seems like the main obligation to employees is to treat people as people, not as mere things. People aren't mere things, and hence they can't rightly be treated in the way we treat tools. But certainly in the Amazon case, and I think it's a fairly widespread, can't speculate how much, kind of idea that employees, the persons constituting the workforce, are really just another factor of production that you have to get the most oomph out of that you can, and that any kind of way of treating that enhances the efficiency of the profit-generating system is thereby justified. But ethics basically, and I'm thinking primarily content ethics, says that's just simply not true, right? That's just simply not – you have to respect people's personhood as autonomous beings, and you're only doing that, seems, if the norms you're imposing on them are norms that they would freely and voluntarily be down with. And what's puzzling to me about the Amazon thing is that so many people did seem to endorse those norms and have them be their own. So in a certain sense, I'm inclined to think, well, they're not being mistreated. They're being treated as persons to the extent that they do endorse those norms. But then I wonder why they're endorsing them, whether it's duress involved or coercive tactics or what sort of psychology it is that drives those people. But a lot of people, obviously the people who left, felt that they were being treated mainly as tools rather than as persons.
Lots of people say, look, if you don't like it, go work somewhere else. And part of me understands that completely, and part of me understands that it can be stressful to quit a job without another one waiting, and not everyone is in a position to do that.
Stressful might be understating it for a lot of people, but I think in the high-tech industry, it seems like those people are in demand and they really are going to get another job, whereas other people might just simply be lost and suffer, a financial disaster by losing their job.
I was going to say, one thing that might be driving this is everybody talks about how successful Amazon is using this particular model that they're working with their employees. Most companies don't ask the question, could we be more successful if we did things differently? That's a hard question for them to ask, because if you think in terms of what drives corporate performance now, it's the financials, it's Wall Street, and other sort of, quantitative metrics that we really focus on, and we really don't look inwardly at processes. We're very outcome driven. And there are people who fit that kind of system, and I suspect those are the ones that are staying longer. But what we know is they like the company. What we don't know is what else is going on.
So if a lot of people hear this and they think, okay, well, I don't want to be complicit in a system, in a corporation that treats people this way. I was thinking about this, and if we take a simple item that we all own, right, a shirt, you need to go buy a new shirt. Am I doing the right thing buying a brand that I know pays factory workers fair wages? Do I need to know about the people producing the raw materials? Do I need to think about the way the retailer or online distributor treats its workers? If I buy online, should I be concerned about the delivery truck driver? On the one hand, I believe all those things are really important. On the other hand, I got a lot going on, and there's only so much I can know before I buy a shirt.
The media makes it easier for us. when we see the stories, we've seen companies over the years, especially in the apparel manufacturing industry, where it has come to light that they are subcontracting and plants overseas with poor working conditions, child labor, and so forth. And consumers were outraged. And they said, I'm not going to buy those products anymore. I can shop somewhere else. And it's made those companies much more conscious of their whole supply chain in the process. And I think a lot of companies are more responsible than they used to be because they know that they're being watched and they're taking a more proactive stance in terms of making sure that their supply chain is as ethical as their company is, because people will walk when they think a company's gone too far, and they have choices.
I've seen a little bit of data on that, and it varies. But for any particular industry, there are numbers out there that say 10 or 15% of the folks who would buy a product from a company in that industry will walk if they discover that that company is engaging in unethical practices in some way. And that can be all the way up the supply chain.
And 10 to 15% is enough to make a big difference.
Well, you know, my question to a company would be, can you afford to lose that off your top line? And most of them can't. But they kind of continue doing what they're doing, unfortunately, until they get caught.
Yeah, what's crucial to that is that they know that there's that it's publicized and everybody knows about it and somebody makes a stink about it, so that enough people will decide to walk over. That 15% will decide to walk, whereas most people might not know anything about it. So in general, I do think we have an obligation when we're faced with some sort of morally disturbing situation to do – if we're positioned to do something about it, we should. But we're really not obligated to engage in futile gestures. And I think just sort of like next time I'm thinking of buying something on Amazon, no, I don't like the way they're doing business. I'll get it some other way. What effect is that likely to have? I think the solutions to this issue and other issues of misconduct in business has to be more of a political collective action kind of thing. Maybe organizing a boycott would be something different from and more effective than just simply, you know, chatting up some people and say, I'm not going to shop there anymore, are you? That kind of thing might not really do very much. But I think there's got to be more concerted efforts to sort of institutionalize reforms across the board in all the companies. So, for instance, if we decide to opt out of Amazon, where does that stop? You listed a bunch of ways in which they're connected with others, but also there's lots of different forms of wrongdoing in the business world. And if you're really going to determine not to be complicit out of some sort of internal moral purity with all the wrongdoing, you'd be opting out of most of life, I think. And we're not obligated to make grave sacrifices to sometimes we are in ordinary circumstances, no disproportionately grave sacrifices. So I think it's really people need to get together and do things to induce changes in corporate culture generally, and not just simply focus on Amazon and not buying their products or something like that.
I was surprised to learn as I was doing a little bit of digging that in terms of particularly products that are manufactured overseas and people worry about labor conditions, there's not necessarily a link between paying a high price for a particular good and knowing that it was produced and by workers who were paid a decent amount, which is not to say that buying the very cheapest thing is better. But we can't even know if we're sort of paying full retail that we are doing the right thing for the people far on the other end of things.
Well, if we could answer the question, why do people behave in the marketplace the way they do, we should band together, form a company, and make millions and billions
and
billions.
But you treat your employees well.
Well, the challenge is that as consumers, mostly we are not knowledgeable about the details of the things that we buy. We may be good in certain particular areas and so on, but we're not knowledgeable in all of the nitty-gritty of those things. And the other thing is there's factors that go beyond just what we might call features and primary benefits of a product that some of us are willing to pay for. I mean, think in terms of, you know, who's driving the $100,000 car. I don't have a problem with anybody doing that, but that car will get you from point A to point B, like the $15,000 car, perhaps a little less comfortably, and so on. But if people are willing to pay for those kinds of things, that's really hard to capture in terms of the nature of the marketplace.
We are at a point of relatively low economic growth, at least compared with what we've known since the end of the Second World War. So should we assume that the only way to get growth going again and is to continue to accept these demands for more efficiency that might hurt human beings? Or are those things not even related, do you think?
I don't think they're necessarily related. I know that a lot of what I've read recently in terms of improving productivity has been replacing labor with capital and the introduction of robotics that replaces the need for, say, for example, warehouse workers because they can transport things around a warehouse using robots that are very, very smart. And there's been I've read some sources that have said it's bringing some jobs back. It's bringing some work back to the United States, but it's not necessarily creating jobs because it's been automated. And so the work is getting done over here again, but it didn't create a job. Now, jobs are probably being created in another sector of the economy that may support that, but those jobs likely require a much higher level of education than the factory worker or the warehouse worker needed to do that job. But it's a really complex, when you look at productivity, it's not just people productivity that we're talking about. And so we don't really know how our products are particularly made and what, you know, influence people had on it versus machines and so forth. But that does seem to be a trend.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I don't know if this is going to push the conversation forward or just offer a little clarity. My son is 23 and has been working for Amazon for about a year now in a computer science-related end. They have non-disclosure forms that they have to fill out that was mentioned in the article, and they don't have a clause that lets you tell your mother everything. So I know in general what he's doing. My sister is the head of a benefits office of a large university near Amazon and advised him how to proceed working there. And he's basically saving his money, enjoying his job. He graduated from the university debt-free. So he accepted this job because they didn't pay quite as much as Microsoft, but it sounded interesting. So that was his motivation for going there. He tends to be a bit driven, so I think he fits that environment. This kid took 7 AP classes in his senior year of high school.
All right, so he's ready for a relentless pace. And as you've all pointed out, there are people who
thrive on it.
Feel like they fit in really well. And then people reported in the New York Times piece, they would leave the company and then think, I don't want to work anywhere else because this is the way I like to do things.
Or he may reach a point in his life where he's married, he has 2 or 3 children, and he realizes he's not spending. And I think they cited someone like that in the article that said, I did great until I had a family, and then it was time for me to make a change. And I think they made a comment that this young man was 26 and he was moving on because he had gotten to a different place in his life where this model didn't work for him anymore.
And it's still disturbing, though, that even for the overachievers who really think this is where I should be, it's still disturbing that even for those people that it's a regular sight to see them break down in tears and feel demeaned by their bosses and demeaned by their and betrayed by their fellow employees and things like this.
Yeah, it does seem that maybe this is going too far, but what reads to me like emotional abuse of employees, it just doesn't seem like there's probably ever a good case for that. Even if you decide you have to, you know, cut certain people from positions because they're not working out, making them feel awful about themselves, it just doesn't seem like a good policy because you're not going to get the best work out of people who are running scared, not for long.
There are ways to do virtually every people-oriented activity in an organization professionally and courteously. And that doesn't mean you can't be straightforward or you can't be, you know, someone who says this is the way it has to be kind of person. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't, you know, those two things are not necessarily hand in hand with being nasty, being rude, lying to people, as is common in organizations and so on. If you're a good manager and you have somebody that you hired that you felt was capable and had all of the things that you thought would be success, make that person successful in your firm, you owe it to that person from a performance perspective, but also from an ethical perspective, to work with that person until you determine that maybe it wasn't a good fit in the hiring process. And that doesn't mean the person's a bad person. It means they're just not a good fit.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Harry in Fort Worth. Hi, Harry.
Okay. I'm thinking of someone who, a female, who worked in a fast food apartment where they didn't even give them a chance to have a legal break. In other words, 10-minute break or something every hour. They're on their feet all day. But then the additional thing is that the person works in what we call a two-wage or in a family. And this is a working mom, and when she gets back home, she's tired, but her husband expects her also to put in a full day's or night's work, so to speak. And you also have another question that when we compare the United States to, say, like Sweden or Denmark, they have more parental leave for, you know, father or mother that's mandated by law, and maybe they have more compliance, too, that when a mom has a baby, she can have a certain period of time to spend with that child, which is better for the society.
Well, Harriet, thank you for your call. You put a lot on the table there. We need to take a quick break now, but we will come back to the conversation with our three experts in just a few minutes. We're talking about business and consumer ethics in light of the Amazon.com revelations printed in the New York Times over the weekend, saying that corporate management practices there require a lot out of employees. My guests for the hour are Steve Hiltz of SMU, Nancy Boyd-Lilly of UNT, and Larry Chunko of UTA. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about the ethics of employment and consumer decisions with three experts this hour. We have Nancy Boyd-Lilly of UNT, Larry Chunko of UTA, and Steve Hiltz of SMU. You can join us at 800-933-5372, which is where we heard a few minutes ago from Harry, who described, a young wife and mother working very hard at a fast food restaurant and not really getting any breaks, and then going home and doing, as you know, many young parents are aware, the kind of second shift at home.
Yeah. Harry's remarks has spurred two thoughts in my mind. One is that here's another example of a common attitude, I'm afraid, in business of regarding the value of people as solely their instrumental value for the purposes of the company, and sort of ignoring their personhood and their respectful – their need for respect and having a life and just their needs being met. And secondly, I liked his idea that part of the solution, I think, needs to be things mandated by law. You mentioned how there's all sorts of leisure time mandated and work day limitations, et cetera, in a lot of other countries. And it seems like you're going to need to do something like that and have it across the board, because it's not it's going to be a bad situation if you simply appeal to the better nature or moral conscience of executives in various important industries, because some of them will take that to heart and actually induce reforms. And those reforms are likely to cause them to incur a cost. Others aren't going to really care about the ethical situation. They won't incur that cost, and now they have a competitive advantage over others. So you end up like the good guys actually get penalized and the bad guys get rewarded. And that's a terrible situation. So you need to sort of institutionalize reforms across the board. And I think the hand of government is often the best way of doing those sorts of things.
We do see some companies that are like recently Netflix said that they're offering paternity leave. And I believe was it a year that they were offering? Mm-hmm. And so there are companies that are willingly trying to make it easier for people to have families and to integrate, to have a balance in their working life and their daily life. But then I've also heard that even in companies that do this, oftentimes employees are reluctant to take full advantage of it or take any advantage of it because they are afraid they'll be perceived as not fully committed right. to the organization. So just the fact that that is offered doesn't mean that people are going to avail themselves of the opportunity.
And the Netflix thing was interesting. At first, I was so excited that somebody was experimenting with this. And then you hear, well, it's for the people who are in office jobs. The people who are, you know, packing DVDs and sending them through the mail don't qualify for this. Mm-hmm. And I do have some ethical concerns with that. On the one hand, maybe those less skilled workers are more replaceable. On the other hand, they're no less human than their colleagues who are working a few floors up.
We seem to have forgotten that a lot of solid business in this country has been built on the person coming out of the manufacturing facility or the distribution center, or if you go to work for a grocery store, your first couple of weeks are going to be doing things like stocking shelves and slicing meat in the meat department and things of that nature. Those people that are on the ground floor in retail, the people that are on the front line managing the cash register and so on, they're the ones who really see the customer and know the customer. And, we can argue about how significant their role is compared to the CEO, but we also don't know whether that's the next CEO that we're talking about that's down there on that cutting room floor right now. And I think where I'm headed with this in a long way is you treat everybody with respect. You expect people to do good work, whatever that happens to be, and you reward them for it.
Back to the phones now. 800-933-5372 is our number. Daveen is on the line in Plano. Hi, Daveen.
Oh, hi. My question is this. With all this discussion, I haven't heard the word union mentioned at all. And it seems to me, I'm retired now, but from my own work experience, and I was never unionized, that a culture that respects unions also respects its employees, whether or not the employees are unionized. And somebody mentioned government intervention, but nobody ever mentioned the word unions. It's as if they did not exist. And I think that that is a big mistake.
Thanks so much for your call.
I did have it next on my agenda to mention something like that, actually, because I think a more democratization of the workplace would end the kinds of employee abuse that we see at places like Amazon. I don't think you'd ever see anything like that in an employee-owned company. And to echo her remarks, I don't think you'd ever see any of that in a unionized company because the working conditions themselves are part of the bargaining deal.
Right.
Or even having a worker representation on the board of directors as occurs in places like Germany, I think there'd be less chance mm-hmm. of a kind of harsh work environment being imposed on people. So I think everybody should be unionized.
But unions are at an all-time low in terms of the number of employees that are represented in the United States. And the sectors of the economy that we've been talking about are very difficult to unionize as well. So, and of course, in areas like at Amazon, where you're talking about professional people with professional technical skills and so forth, they typically don't even think of themselves as being a union member. And so those types of organizations are not likely to get unionized very easily. So we've seen, as I said, we've seen a very steep decline in the number of employees in the United States that are unionized.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Joey in Denton who writes, "It's truly abhorrent what the article brings to life, but I find it rather comical, the tidal wave of interest in the white-collar worker. While stories of death and mistreatment of contract workers or laborers on work sites, especially here in Texas, makes mere ripples."
I'm not sure how I will answer that question, but let me give a shot. Amazon is a superstar company in a sense, a very popular company, almost a highlight film kind of company. And so there's a tendency to say, well, we want to beat them somehow. And so we'll sort of talk about this. We'll do this expose or things of that nature. It's almost like, you know, if you're playing sports, I want to beat the number one team worse than I want to beat the last place team. That's not to say that those incidents where workers die in construction operations or anything like that are unimportant, but those are not what you know would call exotic kinds of companies necessarily, and so they don't really play well in the press. They don't really grab hold of people's sort of emotions as much as perhaps an Amazon does.
So you're suggesting that problem is part of the cult of celebrity that
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, we saw that. You know, the same thing several years ago when they went after Apple and the Foxconn plant in China, which of course I think eventually it came to light that some of that was fabricated, some of the facts that were presented in that expose. But again, they were going after a very high profile company, and it's my understanding that it brought attention to things that did result in some good coming out of it. When that kind of thing is called to the public's attention, it does oftentimes result in some sort of reform. The company goes, yeah, maybe we need to do some things a little bit differently.
Do employees, I mean, this sounds, I don't mean for it to sound harsh, but do we have an obligation as workers to try very hard not to get ourselves into these situations? Is there some responsibility on the part of people choosing jobs? Because it is, you know, a job interview is a two-way process. Sometimes you're really desperate and you need a job and you don't feel like you have a choice, but sometimes you do have a choice.
I think it is a responsibility. I think it is more of a prudential responsibility than a moral one, though. But I often tell my business ethics classes, you know, to think more about if you're lucky enough to get two job offers when you graduate, don't just go with the one with the most money. Think about a lot of things, what kind of culture you're going to be a part of, whether you're going to be autonomous on the job, have a lot of leeway, it's your own deal that you're doing, or just simply be micromanaged. And there's a lot of things to be thinking about and that are worth ultimately more than mere money. I get the impression that that's the first time they've been confronted with that thought.
I tell my students the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it speaks to the issue that I think we've talked around but not directly addressed, and that is that every company has a culture. And what we saw in the article on Amazon reflected the culture of Amazon. And oftentimes that culture is a direct reflection of the top people. And in this case, the CEO who, you know, oftentimes these CEOs in these companies like this are the founding CEO. And their culture, they've molded this culture. And so when you talk to students in class, you say, you know, you need to look beyond the paycheck. You're exactly right. Is this a place where I'm going to fit in? And is this a place that I'm going to be happy working for? Does this meet my career goals? And also, what kind of doors might open?
And it's kind of hard to know in advance what you're going to get, because if you distinguish between the formal culture and informal culture, if you read those 14 articles of faith or whatever they called it at Amazon, they seem pretty cool.
And
I thought that's pretty cool. I'd like to work for a company like that. I'll be a leader. I'll do those things. Yeah. But then when you realize how the tone at the top interprets those things and what actually they demand from you and think is falling under those, that might be something you had no idea of ahead of time, that that was going to be expected of you if you're living up to those ideals.
And it seems like, you know, obviously leaders want to get the best possible performance, not necessarily the most performance, but the best performance out of each employee. But, you know, Jeff Bezos, he founded the company and this is his baby. It's not the baby of someone who came along 15 years later and is just trying to put food on the table and may have some professional aspirations. But it seems strange to me that there are CEOs who don't understand that their commitment to this is necessarily going to be greater than those of every single employee working down the chain.
Well, I think if you really think in terms of a CEO as a leader, they are the role model. And so they need to be very conscious of what they say, how they say things, what they do, and so on, because that is going to filter down, and it may take some time, but it'll filter down the tiers of the organization to all the way at the bottom when we were talking about young people taking their first job. My counsel to my students is go in there, do the best that you can, work hard. Always treat the people you encounter with respect, because you'll get that respect back if you do. And I think that's kind of maybe a moral obligation,
yes,
more than a performance obligation.
It's the prime moral obligation.
Yeah. And so it can work both ways. But you have to have that filtering down from the top before the young people at the bottom really will pay attention to it and get it.
The old sort of joke, you know, the hard-driving tech company puts ping pong tables in the lobby or, you know, a break room with video games that I think most people are probably loath to be seen using. I mean, are there things that that Amazon will need to do now to demonstrate that it has a commitment to being better? Or do you all anticipate this will blow over and nothing will change?
I think it'll blow over because he seems to be all about efficiency and metrics, and that's our model, and growth depends on this, and we're in it to win it kind of thing. And I really don't think there'll be much. There'll be some efforts to sort of paper over or reform some of the more egregious meannesses that were imposed on people, but when he responded, it's sort of like, well, that's not the culture we see usually. And if anybody had known these things were happening, of course we'd take care of those. But he didn't really address the whole idea of, you know, like, you know, just try to work your employees like slaves aspect of things at all. Right?
Yeah. In an ideal world, I would say this is an opportunity for him to take the company and run with it and say, what do we need to do to fix these issues that have been mentioned in this article? And I don't know what they have in place, but if you're talking about unethical behaviors occurring in organization, then you clearly have to have a fairly solid code of ethics, but not just this, you know, a selection of thou shalts and thou shalt nots. You have to have rules of engagement. You have to have things in place that say when an ethical breach is discovered, here's how it's going to go down. And if it's discovered that it truly was ethical or unethical, here are the penalties that might accrue as a result of that. And that would be voluntary. I tend to agree with Steve. I think that the only thing that might change this would be if the lawsuits get to be too serious.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're going to come or not, but there's some conversation already about class action suits and things like that.
Larry Chonko is professor of business ethics at UTA. Nancy Boyd Lilly is professor in the Department of Management at UNT. Steve Hiltz is an adjunct professor in the Department of Philosophy at SMU. Thank you all so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day. Thank you.